Emo. Emotional music for emotional people. E. M. O.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another week, another episode here of Classically Emo. I'm recording this from my desk right now, which is interesting. I normally record this from the comfort of my couch, so new week, new me, I suppose. It's been an interesting ride, I guess, doing this podcast so far. There's a couple, you know, albums that I was really looking forward to this whole time when I started planning and mapping this whole thing out. Of course, it was the first one I thought of was Pinamino. There's another record that I really want to talk about, but I haven't quite scheduled, I haven't got on the books quite yet, so no spoilers, but this week's episode is also one that I've really been looking forward to for a lot of reasons. One, I love this record a tremendous amount, and James Shotwell and I have done a couple episodes of previous podcasts together here and there, so he's a great guest. We always have a great time chatting and catching up, and this was it was a great time. I mean, I could say so much about this record and how great it is, how much I really love Armor for Sleep and What to Do When You Are Dead, which, of course, if you're listening to this, you know that's the record because you're probably sitting here staring at your phone going, why the fuck is he not just saying the record? So there you go. Listen, Armor for Sleep, James and I talk about it quite a bit. I think they were a band that struck fucking lightning in a bottle with this record. And then, you know, they kind of tailed off a little bit with their next one and then broke up and then have intermittently been coming back and doing anniversary shows for this. So I think there's understanding that this record is pretty much their magnum opus in every facet. And it's just, if you think of what quote-unquote emo music sounded like in 2005, this is a record that encapsulates all that. You know, it's a concept record, which James and I talk about that quite a bit as well. And it is just, it is early 2000s rounded out to everything it needs it, everything we need it to be, okay? And that's all I'll say right now. But thank you so much for listening so far, getting this far into this episode. And I can't wait to see your guys' thoughts. And yeah, we will see you next week. And after the ad, you can catch me and James ramble for about 45, 50 minutes on What to Do When You Are Dead by Armor for Sleep. All right, what is up, everybody? Welcome back to another podcast episode here where we just constantly dive into emo records. Today, we're going to be focusing on one that I've wanted to do. You know, when I launched this podcast, this is one that immediately came to mind. So I'm really glad that it got claimed pretty quickly. So we've got James Shotwell here joining us for this one. James, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Good. Absolutely. Appreciate you coming on. This is, we're going to do a whole one here on Armor for Sleep, What to Do When You Are Dead. And honestly, we got a lot to talk about with this. But first, James, I guess kind of introduce yourself, talk a little bit, you know, about your introduction to music. You know, if there was, you know, what band or album, I guess, you know, did you first fall in love with, if you can think of that?
My first one. That's tough. First one that comes to mind is I remember having a CDR copy of Swiss Army Romance from Desperate Professional. So
yeah,
that's probably my first one. That one or Bright Eyes Lifted, The Stories in the Soil.
Nice. Yeah, I wish I was a little bit older when like those Dashboard records were coming out, because that was such like, it seems like such an interesting time in music and like what he was doing at that time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It was, I look back on it now more fondly than I thought. Like, you just didn't know what happened.
Yeah.
It was just that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now everything makes a little more sense, right? I mean, he was just the guy with an acoustic guitar coming out of like, you know, his own kind of thing. And I know he did Further Seems Forever at that point. But then, I mean, there wasn't really many people, like, really many bands like him at that time or like what he was doing, you know? So he had a tough time fitting in. Then obviously look at him now. So. Who knew?
Yeah, absolutely. And I probably got into this band when this album came out. I wasn't into the first album like everyone else was.
Yeah.
Whatever, EP, whatever the first thing is they did.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. Well, I know you used to, you've done a lot of music writing. Obviously, you did Subtreme for a while, which is where we kind of first really met. But what took you into music writing as a whole?
I read a book by Abby Hoffman called Steal This Book, and in it, it was all these ways to get free stuff, and the chapter on music was to start, this was released in like 1976.
Sure.
And Abby said, you know, start a fake magazine, and all you had to do was go to like your printer, local printer, and print like a magazine cover, yeah, make up a fake one, send it to record labels, say I have a magazine, and they'll send you records. And I was like, I could do that as a music blog. And
yeah.
So I did that as a music blog, and then inadvertently it became like a career that I still do.
Sure. Yeah.
13 years later.
Yeah, that's funny, man. I honestly, like, that's so, I like, when I started writing about music, I didn't really know what the hell I was doing. So I was in high school, like, I didn't know what I was doing. And it started, like, I was on Tumblr, and I was just like kind of messing around with stuff, just like talking about music I loved. And of course, at the time, I was like a little angry kid, so I talked about music I hated too, for some reason. And then all of a sudden, people started reaching out to me about, like, for their bands. I was like, what the hell do you want from me? Like, what is this? And then, like, so that's really funny that, like, you, I guess, like, more advertently kind of did what I didn't know I could do. You know, like, I had no idea people actually would send me stuff and then offer me, like, tickets to stuff. I was like, what is this? Like, this doesn't seem real.
Yeah, exactly. And I always thought I was pulling something over on everybody.
Right.
I realized that, like, I was doing way more work than yeah. ever planned to.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, you launched a whole full-fledged website out of it, you know, and then that takes up a whole portion of your life, right? And so that's definitely a lot of work. That's no joke there. Wish you would have stuck with the fake magazine, right? Sometimes it would have been a little bit easier, but, you know, it's all right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lifetime of undervaluing myself, all because there you go. Some free music.
They should have included that in that chapter of her book for sure. That was not mentioned much back then.
Yeah. There's no way to steal confidence.
Yeah, no. No kidding. Well, I know you've kind of still been doing that. I know obviously you've got a lot of other stuff going on. So I guess this, what have you been doing lately? I know you've got Holics, which takes up, I think that's your kind of the big day job, right? Quote unquote. So how's that been going?
Yeah, so my day job is that I am the director of marketing and customer engagement for Holics.com. We're the music industry's leading promotional distribution platform, and I handle all marketing for the company. That means I run our blog, I run our YouTube channel, I run two podcasts, and all of our social media. And then in addition to that, I manage customer relations with our 500 clients around the world.
Nice.
So that takes up like a small part of my life.
A small part, yeah.
And then outside of that, I write film reviews still for Substream.
Yeah, absolutely.
Other outlets. I'm covering Sundance as we're doing this right now. So that's happening. And then one of the podcasts I do for Holics, in partnership with Holics, is a personal project, is called High Notes. It's about addiction. Mm-hmm. And recovery in music, and it's really what made me want to do this, was to talk about that show. So we do that.
Yeah.
And last but not least, I find time to write about music sometimes.
That's right.
Mostly band bios, where it's like, I like doing band bios more than journalism, because I feel like when you write for a blog, like Substream, we both write for Substream. Mm-hmm. Like when you write for Substream, you get to be like the guy at Substream that says what this band is about.
Yeah.
If you write the band bio, you're like the person. Like, this is what Hop Mulligan is. Like, everyone else bases their opinion on what they are.
What you write. What you
said. Yeah. It is like being a Pitchfork critic in 2006. It is as influential as you get.
That's right. I mean, you are a voice for those bands, right? I mean, every time like I do like any, you know, premieres or anything like that, obviously they send over the bio, right? So you get like a bio sent over, and like that's that, you know.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, like, those are the words that, like, especially if it's a band that I don't know, you know, like that is undoubtedly sometimes like that is the first thing I click before the music, right? Or like most of the time it's at the same time, you know, like I'll be listening to it. So I can kind of hear what I think, but also like kind of see how it's being pitched to me, you know? Mm-hmm. So like, that's very interesting to like, that's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I thought so too.
Yeah, absolutely. We can talk a little bit about High Notes here, 'cause I know that's something that you just, you launched last year. You did two seasons in a year, right? And I remember you and I did a different podcast back in, oh my gosh, April or something of last year, kind of, and you were talking to me a bit about it. And it was always very interesting. I know it was a very good, I haven't listened to all of season two yet, but I got through season one pretty much like within a weekend, most like most people did, you know. But you guys are still working on more of that coming out, I'm guessing.
Yeah, we have, we're about to announce a mini series within the show. Nice. So we call it 2.5. It's
sure.
It's a label partnership season where every artist is on a very specific record label.
Sure.
And then the official season three, we will start in March and
okay,
kill us
nice.
Until July probably.
Yeah.
But it's I'll give everyone the quick pitch. It's about addiction and recovery. Every episode is basically I serve as the narrator and host of the show, but it's not an interview like what you and I are doing. It's an individual telling their story mm-hmm. about being addicted to drugs and alcohol in the music business and getting clean. And I just cut in as like the helpful narrator connecting the dots between the chunks of audio that we use. And it sounds very polished and fancy.
Yeah.
But it's cool. And we have a lot of cool guests. First season is really heavy on Warped Tour artists. Second season, we get a little bit more out there. This mini season that we're doing is actually about a subgenre of metal that we would otherwise never feature on the show, but because
sure.
of the partnership. It's going to be very cool. And
nice.
Season three, we haven't started yet, so I don't know what it is.
Yeah, absolutely, man. It's a great thing to be doing. Obviously, we've both been in music for a while, and you've kind of seen it all. But it's a very unforgiving kind of industry in a lot of ways, you know, mm-hmm. In terms of just how much pressure there is on everybody, especially once you start to get a taste of success, right? And I know you had, I know Justin from Blue October was on there for the first one, right? You had Anthony yep. Green on there. I think you just had Brian from Korn on there, right? So you've got guys that have had tremendous success for a while, and most of them have all been very vocal about kind of what they, you know, what they went through kind of intermittently, I know. Specifically, like I'm thinking of like Anthony Grant. I know he's kind of talked a bit about it on Twitter, but I think, you know, what makes the podcast work is it's just one, it's like, it's where you hear everything, you know, like I don't think a lot of people would know their kind of full story and that quite, you know, in depth like that, if that podcast didn't happen, you know, they might be like, oh yeah, I know Anthony had some things, or like, you know, Justin's obviously talked about it for Blue October forever. And then so was Brian, but I think people maybe don't know. I don't know if that makes sense. I think people like in their mind, they're like, oh yeah, I know that, but they don't like know it until that podcast came out.
Yes. It's the goal is to kind of not talk about music as much as possible. You know, as
yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Like every episode, like you said, we talked in like April last year, didn't come out until July. Mm-hmm. Every season takes months to create. So there's no point
sure.
in like, what's the new album about?
Oh, right. Yeah.
So it's always like the stuff that happens. What fascinates me is like life between being on stage.
Sure. You know
what I mean? like
yeah.
All those times. And the show is actually only exists because of Anthony Green. He and I talked about the idea a year prior, and then I made mm-hmm. a thing when he relapsed. We were like, now we have to do the show.
Sure. Sure.
So we did that. He's back on the path now. And
yeah.
Now it's a matter of like finding different perspectives on the same experience. Because much like writing music,
yeah.
every person that is dealing with addiction is having their own journey with it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just because you didn't wake up, you know, naked in a hotel somewhere that you don't remember how you got to.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that your story is any less like impactful or important
sure.
or absurd. And I try to make this, we want the show to showcase that it's worth trying to do something differently.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's a great thing that you guys are doing. And, you know, it's always good to see kind of the reaction that it gets, because I think it does open up a lot of conversation around that, which is, you know, a big part. And like you said, a lot of it's not music based, because how many, you know, so-and-so announces a band, how many interviews is it going to do on their music, right? I mean, that's inevitable, you know? I mean, yeah. we could do it on Substream without even thinking about it, you know? Like,
yeah.
So it's interesting that it's a great way to kind of focus on something else, you know, like you mm-hmm. said, between gigs, between albums, you know, what are they doing before, certainly, you know, unfortunately, most of the time after, right? So so that's, yeah, I think it's a great thing. I'm excited to see, you know, 2.5, 3, 4, 5, 6, I don't know however long you want to do it, but I love
as
it.
As
long
it's as
great.
We get guests, I think. Yeah, I don't know. I have bucket list guests, but it's weird. It's hard to, I always say that it's really hard to go to a publicist or an artist or a manager
sure.
and say, hey, do you want to talk about that thing that you would rather not talk about for like an hour?
Sure. Yeah, and just lay it out there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I love it, man. Well, we can we'll love to dive into that. I'll put a link to it and everything so people can check it out. But we will, you know, we'll switch gears here, I guess. We'll kind of switch into music now. We'll kind of bring it full I guess this is being more of a 180 here. We're kind of drifting away from that. But yeah, man, Armor for Sleep, What to Do When You Are Dead. That record came out, it'll be 16 years here next month, which is kind of crazy. And it was out on Equal Vision. It was the second album they released on Equal Vision, which is following the album Dream to Make Believe that came out a few years prior that you mentioned you weren't too big on. And obviously, I was 9 when that record came out, the first one, so like I wasn't really big on it because I didn't really know who they were. And then after this record, they went and signed to Warner Brothers, and then, you know, the rest is history, and the fact that nothing else really happened after that. But what were you doing in 2005 when this record dropped?
2005. 2005. I was a junior in high school.
Okay.
I was 16 going on 17.
Sure.
So I was the exact target audience for this album. I was running at, by that age, I had already opened my own music venue. I was playing music and touring as little as I could in between going to school.
Sure.
So I was already like, I'm going to work for Victory Records one day. And I probably found out about this record. I was trying to figure out today, like, how did I know that this was an album that was like,
yeah.
And I think it was, knowing by that point I was pretty good friends with bands like Hit the Lights and Every Avenue.
Sure.
That was my scene. Those were my peer group that I was around all the
time.
And I remember they talked about this band. Mm-hmm. Again, I didn't know the first record, but when this album was coming out, like everyone was talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I had it written down to bring it up later, but yeah, I didn't hear about them until Snakes on the Plane, because they were on the soundtrack for Snakes on the Plane, much like every other scene band ever, you know, specifically FBR bands, right? So that's, and then that was like a remix on that. So like, that's when I was like, who the hell is this? And then, you know, I listened to the record. I was like, oh shit. I mean, it's, you know, it's a very different record, I guess, you know, than a kind of, where a lot was going on somewhat, you know, and it's they touted it as a concept album, you know, kind of written from that perspective of someone that, you know, dies by suicide and then tells that story of kind of, you know, their journey through the afterlife, which is such a very interesting, like a very interesting idea of a story to tell through music, you know, and one that I don't think they really wanted to do at the time. I think I remember they're doing interviews or talking about it, and Ben was the only one who wanted to do it, and then they eventually came around to it because I guess that's where your, you know, singer pesters you so much about something. What are you going to do? Tell him no. I mean, I guess it gets hard to tell him no after a while, you know, and then you did it. And I think it worked out. Obviously it's one of their, it's probably is their most successful record, I would say.
By a country mile.
By a hot mile. I mean, they did the 10-year anniversary tour for it. Then they wanted to do a 15th anniversary last year, but I think they're doing that this year, presumably. Yep. Maybe.
I have tickets. It's happening.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, I will say the 10-year anniversary one was very good. I would see this again in a heartbeat if it happens.
Yeah, they only put out one other record. It was good, but it wasn't. The thing is, I was thinking a lot today. I don't know what your first question is about it, but I was just thinking
That's
about
right.
this album a lot today, and I could not help thinking, like, it is such a risk to do a concept album. I was trying to think of, like, who a concept album is good for.
Mm-hmm.
Like, nothing that I could come up with, like, on a list of why you do a concept album makes sense for this band to do a concept album. Like, you need, like, to me, you have to be a band that people expect, like, storytelling from. In that
sure.
band, like, mm-hmm. Rush. I think of Rush, Pink Floyd. Those are bands that make concept albums. So you have to be a band like that. Two, you have to, like, really commit to, like, this idea. Mm-hmm. Like, this one big story, and it has to work. And three, if it doesn't work, you have to have, like, a sonic pivot to, like, distance yourself from it in a hurry.
Yeah.
And like, this band doesn't have any of those things. But
yeah.
for whatever reason, they were managed to pull together
yeah.
what is 11, almost 11 songs.
And, yeah.
And it works. The deluxe yeah. edition is what we talk about, all the other stuff and the interlude, but 10 songs mm-hmm. that work really well.
Yeah, they did. I would say, you know, I would say at the very at least they fully committed to it. You know, because I mean, the album itself came from a book titled just simply "What to Do When You Are Dead: Life After Death, Heaven in the Afterlife." You know, which the book itself kind of talks about what happens after we die, and then you know the title is directly pulled from that. You know, mm-hmm. So you know, I think they bought into it, and then I know back when albums had booklets, I don't know if albums still have booklets like this. You know. That really kind of laid the story out in a sense of it talked about, you know, it showed images of a man, you know, in a suit kind of flying around, which is simply on the artwork itself, you know, and then really kind of drove that point home of what these songs were about, you know, and then tied it all together through that booklet. So I'd say at the very least they had that going, you know, that once he convinced them to do it, they really dove into it and said, all right, I mean, let's go for it, you know, and then, yeah, they pulled it off and then, yeah, they still pivoted from it somewhat after that, you know, the next record, which, you know, is what it is. They were going to have a hell of a time following it up anyway. But, yeah, I love it. I love it. I think they, you know, I don't know how they did it because, yeah, like you said, they weren't a band that I think people expected to do anything like this, you know, especially after their first record, which maybe was kind of moderately received in the sense that it wasn't, you know, didn't go – obviously didn't blow up, you know, so – I think this, maybe that's where they came from. They thought, what else do we have to lose? And then they put it all out there.
Yeah. Well, for starters, if I can just do a little correction, the book that it's based on doesn't really exist. It's a book that appears in the movie Beetlejuice.
Okay.
But it's not a real book. However,
interesting.
When you bought the album, if you bought the first round of the record, and I think one of the deluxe versions of the vinyl, the book was inside of it. It was like a flip book that came with the record. And now that's like the most prized collection item that you can have is the actual book. But it is a book that happens to that appears in Beetlejuice when the couple at the beginning of the movie finds out that they're dead and they need help. That book appears in their life. What to do?
I love it. I love it. See, so here's the fun fact. I've never seen Beetlejuice. and I found this book on like Amazon and I was like, what the hell is this? Like, what is this Amazon book?
Nope. Yeah, there's other books that have been named that since, but the source for this specific thing is
fascinating.
A giant Beetlejuice reference.
Fascinating. I love that so much.
Yeah, and the artwork that you see on the outside of the album, that there's an illustrated version of it that was in the booklet that was on the inside, and every page was like illustrated, and it kind of went with themes of the record, but it wasn't like the story of the record. It was just a companion piece.
Yeah, yeah, I love it. Well, there's a few things that I really like. There's a lot of obviously we want to talk about with this record, but I think specifically there's a few songs that come to mind, and obviously the first one is Car Underwater, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of songs we could highlight, but I feel like this one, you know, was the first one they released from the album, and it really, I think, set the tone. Obviously, it's the first, it's the first song on the album too, right? And so releasing that as the first single, I think, was probably the smartest thing they could do. And I know, obviously, they thought well into that, why to do that. And then it tells you, I mean, just plainly what the hell is going on with it, you know. But what did you think? Were you hearing this album? Like, were you hearing these songs as they came out? Or did you find the whole record later?
Car Underwater was the album sampler track. So that, like, back then, Victory Records set the tone by doing a billion promo compilations for their albums, and all the other labels kind of hopped on. So every you had, I forget what the Hopeless one was called, but Hopeless had a really popular one that like helped All Time Low and Thrice and Avenged Sevenfold break, and Equal Vision had their own as well. But the Equal Vision roster was way weirder than everybody else's. So this song was on a sampler with like a song from Fear Before the March of Flames, and those two bands don't really go together very well. But that was like, and then I think maybe it was on the Warped Tour sampler that year. But this was a song that like you were hearing outside of the context of the record. Because like the problem with marketing in 2004 and 5, not even a problem, like the way that we used to do things in the before times was you didn't have the internet to be like, this is from a concept album. So you just had this song that was like an emo banger. That was like,
yeah,
because by this point we've all heard Tell All of Your Friends and we've heard the first Hawthorne Heights record, like the idea of dying and being young and in love were like synonymous at this point. So this record, so that one song checks all the boxes. You were like, this is the next band that's going to be like that. Whether or not you'd heard the first album, and if you hadn't, you had to find it somewhere, which was hard. The sampler was right in front of you. So I heard that going into this record, and then I think it was a friend probably burning it for me first, being like, you need to hear the whole album. So I must have heard it at least Car Underwater, Truth About Heaven, and Remember to Feel Real first, and then onward.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a good point of what you mentioned, that it can like this song obviously existed outside of the record, obviously, first, and then people probably never really obviously there's a group of people that never went back and found the rest of the record for a while, right? And then what makes, you know, this song so good is that it does stick out, and you can listen to it and just think it's literally, I mean, it's just, you could think it's a one-off song, right? And you said it checked all those boxes. It does. And then you've got that line of, you know, I didn't care that you left and abandoned me, what hurts was I would still die for you. I mean, that is like an emo calling card in and of itself, right? I mean, that's a very 2005 lyric, even outside of the rest of the album, you know. And so I think what's so funny about that is that it became this thing that this song is obviously their career defining song, right? I mean, it's their top song on Spotify. It's the song that, it wasn't the first song I heard from them, but like I listen to it now and I'm like, yeah, this is like, I don't know which song they wrote first. I just convinced myself that this is a song they wrote first, and they said, fuck it, we're going after this idea, you know? And I think if they did that, then that makes all the sense in the world. Cause if you started out with this song, like, I don't know. I guess I'm thinking like the track listing is so laid out, obviously, to follow the story. Like, it makes sense to think that they like actually wrote it that way. I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, let me ask you this. What was the first song you heard from this record? Was it Car Underwater?
It was Remember to Feel Real, because that was the one on Snakes on a Plane.
Oh, okay.
That remix was the one on Snakes on a Plane. Yeah.
Be on Snakes on a Plane. See, in my brain, like, I definitely heard the song before I saw the video, but I remember watching Ben Jorgensen sit on the back of a car going down the street in the music video for Car Underwater, and I was just like, this guy gets it. No, it's The Truth About Heaven. He's riding around in the back of the car. The Truth About Heaven, because he's like, he's supposed to be the ghost. But I remember like being around bands trying to make music videos and trying to make content before we called it content, and like, oh, this guy found a way to just sit on a car and like make a music video. Like, it was not a complicated shot or anything.
Yeah.
It's not like a fancy car. Like, he's literally, it's like a Honda or something that he's riding around on the back of. It looks so cool. And like, now it's cheesy. Now it's so incredibly cheesy. And like, I watched the video today. There's a moment, it's like a two-story house, and the band is like on the different levels of the roof, and the girl's like walking around not noticing that there's like a band just rocking out. And then she's sitting in the backseat of this car, and Ben Jorgensen is literally leaning on the back window of this car, just like hand pressed against the glass, longingly singing to the doesn't know he's there. And like, that image is now forever seared in my brain. And I know that he's like 40 now, but in my head, he still looks like that and acts like that.
He does. His
beautiful wife, Katrina Bowden, or whatever her last name is.
Yeah.
Something about that. And I was just like, oh, these could be my friends. These are the guys I relate to. These could be. And that, from that video onward, I think I was just like, I'm a fan of this band for life. Like, this guy gets it. He gets what it's like to be 17 and sad.
Yeah, so I just looked up how old he was, and he's 37 now, which makes all, like, it's weird, but like, it makes all the sense in the world, because his record came out 16 years ago, you know. But in my mind, I don't think he's 37, you know. And yes, Katrina Bowden is his wife's name. And
best known as the secretary from 30 Rock.
That's 30 Rock. What else has she been on? She's been on a couple of soap operas. So she's out there. I mean, honestly, as much as I want him to make music again, like, I don't blame him. Like, he's got a great setup, you know?
Yeah. He's married he's got to a great kid. Actress. She was in Sex Drive. She's in Tucker and Dale vs. Evil. She's in Piranha 3DD.
Now, that's a movie, man. Tucker and Dale vs. Evil is so good.
There's a movie with a hashtag in it that she's in that I always think about whenever I see her name, and I can't think of what it is right now, but it's like the first direct-to-video horror movie that was like hashtag die or something like that.
I'm not quite sure, but hashtag that's a great horror movie, man. I mean, listen, so hey, he got to write a record that could almost be like a horror thing, right? And now look at him. If they ever wanted to make that into a musical, they could. And I think, obviously, it's not big enough. It's not a big enough record, but I think there's a way you could do that, and it would be phenomenal.
Yeah, and you know, honestly, though, like, we can say that it's not a huge album, but if you put it in the context of the scene that it comes from, in July 2007, the record had sold 200,000 copies, like physical copies of the album were sold, which is more than probably any Wonder Years album has sold. Period.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. that's true.
The problem is that it all happened before Twitter, before the internet, before, like,
sure.
Like, if this record came out when Tumblr was big, like in 2010, everyone would still talk about Armor for Sleep as if they're the best band.
Sure.
But now they're almost like, they're like classic emo rock.
Right. Yeah, they're like a they almost feel like a cult kind of, not a cult thing, but like movies have like cult classics, right? Like, that's what I think of when I think of What to Do When You Are Dead. And yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, it was a big enough record that they got signed to a major label after, you know. Mm-hmm. So it hit, what does it look like? It peaked at like number 101 or so on the Billboard charts, which again, like, you're right, at that time was kind of big for them, considering they came from their first record that didn't do anything on the charts, you know. And then it has exploded. And then, you know, this was like that peak, kind of end of that peak era where MTV was like highly influencing, you know, people's music taste, you know. And I'm guessing that those music videos were in high rotation on there. So that's my best guess, as someone that like was watching MTV, but like not really watching MTV at the time. I just remember flipping between MTV and VH1 and somewhere in like 2003 watching an Our Lady Peace music video. And that's what I remember distinctly. So that's my music television.
Lot. Yeah. In the early 2000s, you could wake up at 7 a.m. before school and MTV would just be playing music videos. That's when they would sneak in Taking Back Sunday video.
That's right.
When they thought nobody was watching.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Then we were all just getting ready for high school. And hindsight, that's exactly when Taking Back Sunday wanted their music video to be playing. So I love it. Well, I wanted to talk about Remember to Feel Real. We've already talked about it a little bit because I wanted to bring up that it was on Snakes on a Plane soundtrack, which is where I heard them first.
No, I appreciate that. That's your interest. I mean, honestly, this morning I was trying to figure out what the best song on the album is. And I think up until A Quick Little Flight, which is like the interlude on the record.
Yeah.
I think the record gets better with each subsequent track. Like, it's an album where all the way through Stay on the Ground, each song you're like, oh, I like this one too. I love this one too. And then it's weird. I would love to know why A Quick Little Flight exists, other than they realize that The More You Talk, The Less I Hear, which is a good song, but is not as strong as those first five tracks. They were like, we need to reset. They can't possibly make another 10 out of 10 song.
And then right.
I think the rest of the record is good, but I don't think that it's as good as the first five songs.
Sure. That's so funny, because I actually really like The More You Talk, The Less I Hear. Like, to me, like, so that's like, that's the song that I think, that's my cutoff point for the song. Like, kind of what you mentioned, I think that's where like it tails off a little bit. And I love all of the record. I think it's a very good record, like start to finish. But like, I do think it tails off. And I mean, that's just most Scene records at that time do tail off at that, you know. I mean, it's, it's 11 songs, and if we're being unfortunately honest, not a lot of them, like, they all after like track for you, track, you know, five for me, this song, they all kind of start blending together, you know, like you've heard it before, you know. And that's fine because it continues the story of the album, which is really what they wanted to hammer home. But I think if I were to look at my, like, the, if I were to analyze kind of the amount of times I've stopped after number seven, it's probably most of the time, you know. Unless I wanted to listen to End of Fraud, which is a pretty good, like, closing track, right? I think that's the last song on the album, The End of Fraud.
But it's cliche, which is, right? Because it's like,
yeah,
it's stupid long. It's way longer than the rest of the album.
It's it 5 minutes, yeah.
Builds. It's like there was a thing like back then when, but again, before streaming, because we could talk about how streaming influences song length all day.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Back then it was like, we have to have a big closer. Like, it has
you
to
do.
We're building to something here. And which is ironic because every time they've put out the record since and all the deluxe, they always add more songs after that. They
I know they've got, yeah, they did that iTunes bonus track, very invisible one. Then they reissued the vinyl last year with about 10 demos. You know, I think it's a demo of almost every song on the record, plus a few from Dream to Make Believe. So, yeah, I mean, they added them on there and it gets longer and longer. I'm like, I don't need it to be longer. I just need this. Like, you could almost wipe off two songs. I'd be sweet. I'd be great, you know? Yeah. But yeah, I think Remember to Feel Real, for me, like, that's probably my favorite song of theirs. Maybe that's just because that's the first song I heard from them, even if it was a remix. But, like, I went and found the non-remix version, obviously, because it didn't, you know, Snakes on a Plane remix is okay. But I was like, you know, what is this? And, like, when I listened to it, I was like, this is sweet. Like, it's a, you know, it's a generally speaking, it's like a straightforward kind of pop punk song, you know, and that's also a song that really can exist out of the record and be like, yeah, like, this is an emo song. Like, I am very, like, not well listening. Like, I am very upset about something listening to this song. And that's how it works, you know?
Yeah, it is a really good song. That it is cliche. It is cliche emo. I didn't think about that until you said that, because it is like, here's the truth. You're right. I'm wrong. I don't have any praise. I'm living a lie. And then it gets into the emotional manipulation of pop punk, because then in the bridge, it's all like, nothing's here for me but you. And, like, you know, yeah, this guy has killed himself already. So, like, he's preemptively guilting her and realizing that she wasn't good enough for him not to kill himself.
Yeah. Gaslighting after death, yeah, man. That's a trip.
Gaslighting. And but it is a great song. And the way that the distortion and the guitars and even just the tone of the guitars in the song is so good.
Yeah.
It is like, I remember being a teenager and hearing this, they'd be like, this is a real rock song. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't sound like a Victory band.
It doesn't. Like, yeah.
I guess my favorite song on the record is probably Awkward Last Words.
Sure.
Because it's, to me, and the weird thing about this being a concept album, and this goes into why I like this song so much, is because it has a theme and it has a through line, but either Ben Jorgensen or anybody else can actually tell you a story that goes from track one to track 11. It's like,
sure,
it's about this, kind of.
Right.
And this song, I think, is the clearest example that isn't directly like, then the guy killed himself and then he felt bad about it and then he missed his girlfriend. This song is an actual song about whether or not killing yourself is a smart idea.
Yeah.
And like how the notion, and not to pry into your personal life too much, but in my own experience of like suicide ideation, it's like there is a very real moment where like the idea of like, this is the last thing anybody's ever going to hear from me or the last thing I'm ever going to say to somebody, and how wanting to get that right can possibly save your life, because
yeah,
I don't want it to be dumb. I don't want to be dumb. And the song really struggles with that idea of like, doing something you can't undo is like the whole idea of that song. And it's like the anchor in the middle of the drama that,
yeah,
only works because we allow ourselves to think that it's a clear story, but it's not.
Yeah.
Like, you can't,
it's definitely not. Absolutely.
You can't tell me like the three acts of this story. It's mostly like, song one is all of act one, and then there's 10 songs for the rest of the story, and the next four are all pretty much death isn't what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Now what?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. You nailed it with this song. I mean, the literal first line of this song is, I want to live again, right? I mean, it's like, oh, shit, you know? And, like, yeah, not to go too deep down that rabbit hole, but, like, in my experience, like, when I attempted suicide, right? Like, I did it, and, like, immediately after, like, there was a time, like, 5 minutes after, and I was like, well, fuck. Like, I called my mom. I was like, hey. But, you know, I went through that because, yeah, like, there's a very real moment. And I think that's what this song illustrates, that, you know, even before you even act on it sometimes, you're like, damn, like you said, I don't really want this. Like, what the hell did I do last? Like, what am I saying, my last text, or like, blah, blah, blah. Like, it becomes very real, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where this song really starts off, and then that's where it exists, you know.
Yeah, it might be the most real song on the album, because it's like,
yeah,
it's not like, this is, it kind of strips away there, it's not even about the story as much as like, if this can be a single, kind of like Car Underwater, this song can be a single without needing a concept album. Like, if they just put out Awkward Last Words, you'd be like, this is a really good song about suicide.
You'd be like, this is a very good song about, like, clearly, in this, you could even say in the story of this singular song, someone's either done it or they're thinking about it. You know, yeah.
And if I was writing a review of the album today, I would say the biggest criticism is that almost every song is itself self, like, it doesn't need all the other songs.
Right. Yeah.
Like Car Underwater, same idea. It's like, like, even all the way down to both these songs deal with, like, I can't breathe. I told you not to believe in me. I messed up. I'm sorry. Like, that's,
yeah.
Every song is just that over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still catchy. And maybe it's just because
I'm
at the same point in time. But I, you know, speaking to what happened to Armor for Sleep after this record, the next album, I was super stoked on, because I was like, these guys can tell a story. And the second album doesn't tell the third album, Smile for them, doesn't tell a story the same way. And
you're
immediately like, where's the theme? Like,
what are we doing, guys?
It feels like it feels lazy in comparison.
Mm-hmm.
We're like, oh, so this time you just wrote 12 songs?
This time you're like, well, we got that out of the way. Here you go. You know, here's an album just of whatever, you know. And it's so interesting. I remember, like, not to get sidetracked on Smile from them, but like that, like the artwork and then like the name itself, like you could almost think that it could be like another album of like a story of like, okay, like obviously one, they went from Equal Vision to a major label, and then they worked with the producer Machine. Like, you've got all of these literal eyes on you, and the artwork shows all of these cameras and microphones on this kid sitting in a chair, right? Mm-hmm. So like, you could have done something with that, and then they didn't, you know. And I don't know why. I don't know if that was really their choice. I don't really know what happened there, but yeah, like that, I would agree that record, like, really kind of let down, you know, despite having a song in Transformers. Like, that was like the big thing. They got their song in Transformers, and then nothing really else happened for them, you know.
Yeah, well, I think it's exactly what happened to The Starting Line, almost down to what I guess you could loosely call the concept of the record, which is the Starting Line had this massive album, and then they went to Based on a True Story. And what is Smile for them, if not another way of saying Based on a True Story? Even all the way to the artwork, which is just a camera focusing on
a
camera, being like,
sure,
here's what you think life is.
Yeah, here's,
But I love it. Does get off straight, but the thing, like, today I listened to this album again today. I went to the grocery store, because that's what adults do.
And listening to Armor for Sleep, I love it, yeah.
Yeah, with my headphones listening to this song. I came up with an excuse to go to the grocery store just so I could listen to the record one more time.
Nice.
We talked. And what stands out to me is that it's still so catchy and so immediately good. And I think here's a question I wanted to ask you.
If
this album came out today, do you think it would be as big as it was in 2005? Would this work today?
I think it would work today. I think they could do it. I don't know if it would be as big as it was in 2005, because it's not is new. I mean, there have been concept albums from bands since, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, there were concept albums before this, and you know, the most successful concept album after this record came out was certainly the Black Parade, right? And then, you know, that is almost a more successful What to Do When You Are Dead. You know, like story wise, it's kind of similar. Like, it's pretty similar-ish, you know? They just blew it out of the fucking water. I mean, they were a bigger band before, you know, obviously, from Three Cheers, you know? But I would almost feel like if this record came out today, they would get accused of ripping off the Black Parade, you know? Yeah. But I think it could work. Like, I think, you know, if there's a legacy behind of this record, I think that it has actually aged pretty well, you know, especially considering some of their peers at the time, like some of those other, you know, records. Like, I love Taking Back Sunday, but objectively I can say Tell All Your Friends hasn't aged well, and I know they feel the same way, you know, just, you know, lyrically and like musically, how he was 18, right, when that record, or when they recorded it, so like stuff like that, you know. But I think, yeah, I think the record's aged very well. I don't know. I think it wouldn't do as well. I think you nailed it earlier. I think if it came out in 2010, it would have been even bigger. You know, I think it would have been bigger in 2010, just because of what Tumblr was at that time. I mean, Tumblr blew the hell out of Man Overboard, for God's sake. I mean, you could blow up Armful for Sleep on that, you know, on that website.
Oh, man, there's so many, like, good one-liners and, like, car under. Like,
oh, yeah.
I picture the images with, like, big bubble text on top of it. Like,
yeah.
And, like, this album was made for that. Because I remember writing the lyrics, like, on my notebook, or, like, AIM was a thing then. So, like, under car under water was, like, your away message, you know?
Yeah.
but it missed the boat. And I agree with you. I do think it could be big today. I think today it would almost be better because singles matter so much more.
Sure. Yeah.
We can agree that they have at least five strong singles here.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So that the whole record would be a hit because most bands don't have five radio worthy songs anymore.
Sure.
In this genre.
Yeah. I mean, they like this. So this record came out in 2005, and that was kind of towards almost the tail end of like this kind of music being big on the radio, right? So. Mm-hmm. However, now you've got Sirius, and I think they would succeed on Sirius. You know, I don't know how big Sirius was 2005, if it was really around, but it's safe to say it's substantially bigger now than it was, right?
Yeah,
so like they would do pretty well on Sirius, and obviously as, you know, time has gone on, that like kind of satellite radio has only gotten more popular. So as like something like Adobe, so like I feel like they would be having those different avenues. However, at the same time, though, there's no Warped Tour for them anymore. You know, they did Project Revolution with Linkin Park for, you know, I think before or right around Smile for them. So I think they lose some, but they win some. You know, I think there's pros and cons if this record came out today for them. You know, but I do agree, like, generally, it could do pretty well still.
Yeah. Equal Vision wouldn't put out this album today. That's for sure.
No, they would not.
Hopeless would put out this album today. They'd probably listen to Hopeless in 2021.
They would be. I love it. I mean, I would take that, though. I mean, like, you know, and even if you look back on, like, when this record did come out, like, how people felt about it, you know, obviously their fans loved it, and you heard it because someone was like, you've got to hear this record, you know? And so I think generally people liked it then. I know they got a lot of, you know, critics. They worked with Machine on this record too, you know, who had brought some of his like kind of metal, quote unquote, metal work to this one, you know. And then I know at the time they got compared by some. I looked this up earlier, not when I was writing these notes a few weeks ago or whatever, that they got some compares unfavorably to a band like Brand New, which I think musically makes sense, some lyrically. You know, and I think outside of all of that, I think those people would look back on it and either feel the same or they wouldn't feel worse about it. You know, I think at best, this record for me has aged well. I think at worst for people, they would feel the same now that they did about it 15 years ago. You know, I don't think anyone would say this record has gotten worse over 15 years.
No, I think it's aged like fine wine, and it's due in part to the fact that it doesn't deal with heartache in the way of like you broke my heart and now I'm alone.
Yeah,
it's things that you appreciate more as you get older: life, death, regret, guilt.
Yeah,
timeless feelings.
Yeah.
And I think that's why they can still do 15-year tours and sell out. Maybe mm-hmm. venues are a little bit smaller, but that's
sure.
That's all money.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, for absolutely. And like we said earlier, I mean, he's obviously, you know, his wife is very successful in like acting. I know he still does stuff. Obviously, I don't know. It's not like music based stuff like this. Right. You know, it's not like he's just sitting at home on his ass for, you know, 8 hours while she's working, you know. But like, I think, yeah, when this band gets back together to do shows, you know, they're doing venues that sure, maybe a little bit smaller, but like, does it really matter? Like, they're not a full fledged band anymore. Like, they come back, you know, they do the shows, and it's, you know, bluntly put, it's a cash cow at that point. You know, it's obviously not like a big cash. It's not like it's pulling in millions of dollars, you know, but it is almost like extra money, you know. And I don't want to say they're only doing it for money, but honestly, if they're go for it, like I don't put down artists for doing that, because you don't make money these days anyway. Why not do something like that, you know? But I think they do enjoy the record, and I think they know that people enjoy it, and that's why they do it. And then obviously the money is a nice little on top, you know. But it's so good, and I love that they're doing stuff for it still. And honestly, part of me is like, I would love to hear new music from them, but also like, I don't need new music from Armor for Sleep, because I got new music from Armor for Sleep after this record and didn't really like it as much, you know. Mm-hmm. And then they did that one EP after Smile for them that I think was okay. But I just don't think there's a market. I don't think they were a band that we talked earlier about, like, you know, if this record came out today, it would do well. But I don't think if Armor for Sleep put out new music, I don't know that it would really go that well, if that makes sense. Like, I don't think people need new music from them, you know?
No, I mean, I was looking at their Spotify today, and I saw they have 175,000 monthly listeners, which is, like, decent.
That's a respectable amount for them, yeah.
But, I mean, Hot Mulligan has 280,000. So, like,
sure.
They're, what, almost half as popular as Hot Mulligan?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't think that bodes well for putting out new music.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they wouldn't.
Even if you look at the other bands that, like, you know, they always do that fans also like, the only mm-hmm. ones that are still regularly putting out music are Senses Fail and Hawthorne mm-hmm. Heights. And everyone else is broken up or only does
sure.
tours. So,
yep.
what's the point? What are we doing?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's probably why they haven't done it, because obviously they're all busy, but there's just, you know, again, there's just not that much of a demand for it. And honestly, I respect that out of them too, because if you know there's not, why would you even bother? You know, like, I think they know, which is probably kind of signaled by those anniversary tours and nothing but those anniversary tours, that this record is essentially what Armor for Sleep is. You know, I don't listen to their first record that much. There's a few songs in it I like off Dream to Make Believe, but not really that much. I think My Town is a pretty good song. All Warm is okay. And then off Smile for Them, The End of the World is a good song. That's the Transformer song. But then that's probably it for me, you know. And it's not, you know, that's fine. It's just, you know, we talked about it earlier, but it didn't stick the same, you know, didn't come out as strong, and just kind of, you know,
yeah.
Was the end of their band.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the only song off that record that I still listen to is Williamsburg, which was the actual
sure.
single.
Oh, man.
But
is that the one with the picking the nose lyric?
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the problem is like, an album like What to Do When You're Dead is so easy to market because there's mm-hmm. an idea, but also like the album art is so like it sticks with you, right? That guy floating.
Yeah.
So all the things that they made, they could just use that image and it was good. But Smile mm-hmm. for Them. Also, the same argument can be made for Dream to Make Believe, which is just like a couch with a window behind it.
It's yeah.
Like, what I don't know how you sell the band. Like, they weren't the best looking guys in the world.
Sure.
Like the most successful group ever. So without having mm-hmm. like a cohesive release strategy, like it was just not going to work.
Yeah.
And it didn't, which yeah. is fine. Which is fine.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Again, there's. I mean, listen. There's a lot of bands at that time. I mean, 2005 was when this kind of music, those early 2000s. That was this. There's no shortage of music from that time that like will likely be covered on this podcast, right? So the fact that they broke through in any way. I mean, selling 200,000 copies in what you said it was what by two July years. Or something. Yeah. So 2 years. So that's insane. I mean, you're right. That's more than the 1 year of probably sort of any single record. you know, there will probably be a time many, 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 many years from now. I don't know if this record is ever going to get a gold certification, but it was halfway there before streaming even took off, right? I mean, it could get there, I guess. I mean, just give it, I don't know, another decade maybe. I don't know. But Carter Water has 10 million streams, you know, and the next one's half of that, which is Truth About Heaven. So very clearly, like, this is, like, in Car Underwater specifically is the one that's getting all the plays, you know. But who knows?
But enough of those can push it to be a gold record.
Yeah, like, I mean, enough of that's why I said give it 10 years. I mean, it could get there. I mean, I don't know if it's really going to take. I don't know how many. I forget how many streams it takes to count as one sale. Too many, I think, like an abundance amount. But who knows? I mean, it's a record. If any record is going to get there, it's going to be this one for them. So that's the biggest thing. And kudos to them, because even having a gold record isn't easy. Selling 200,000 copies of a record is not easy either. So, you know, they had their time and it was, you know, short at that. So what else can you say? Good
let
for
me,
them.
Let me disappoint you real quick and tell you that a single album sale is considered 1,500 streams. So even 10 million streams, Car Underwater has only done the streaming equivalent to 6,600 sales.
They might never hit a gold record. Never mind.
Yeah, we've got to rethink our. We were so proud of it, but this is the problem with streaming, folks. Is 10 million seems like a lot until you break it down to album sales, and it is. It would be considered a failure if it only did.
Yeah, 6,000. But to be fair, that's only one. You know, it's only one song. I mean, Truth About Heaven has 5.8. So you're looking at half of that, so roughly 3,000 there.
So 10,000
more units. So they're at least yeah, but there we go. Just from Spotify and the lot. But Spotify is, I mean, they've probably been on Spotify for nearly the whole time Spotify's been around, right? So
Listen, they're doing fine. They're doing fine.
Yeah. They hey.
I don't know what any of them do for money these days, but they seem
to. Yeah.
So that's all that matters.
That's the thing. As long as, like I said, you know, if they seem to know kind of what their, you know, that their time came and went, that nobody, you know, nobody's asking for new music, so why would they bother? If they're happy doing whatever they're doing, then good for them. And it's, yeah, I mean, they had their success, and some, you know, some bands kind of suck it out. I know you mentioned Hawthorne Heights, but Hawthorne Heights is a very interesting case of they're not selling records like they used to, but yet people, like, they still have, like, a core set of fans, you know, that care about them. So each band is very different, but Armor for Sleep, this record, at the very least for them, they put out, for me, like a record that's like classic in that emo sense, that it's very good. Mm-hmm. And that's not easy to do.
I'll be listening to it and unnecessarily relating to it until I die, probably.
I'll be there for that 30th anniversary tour. That's what I like to hear. I mean, mm-hmm. I want to see a 50-year-old Ben Jorgensen singing Car Underwater. That's what I want. So
I'll be there with bells on for the 15 years. Yeah. Whenever it happens, 17 years, 18 years, whenever it happens.
Yeah, whatever anniversary ends up being at that time, I'm gonna be there because this record is phenomenal. And I don't even know who they're touring with. It doesn't matter who they're touring with. They could just play this record, get me home by 9 o'clock, and that'd be the best show of my life. So
yeah, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whatsoever. In fact, no. What they should do is join forces with a band that is still selling records and just be the direct support and do it like that. Like people come out and see them and then can see that.
Hey, Thursday did that a few years ago, didn't they? Mm-hmm. That seems familiar. Like they did, I forget what record they did, but they did that as an opening band. And hey,
that's smart.
They could tour with Senses Fail. That would be a solid tour, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That makes a lot of sense.
All right, man. This has been a lot of fun. I hate to jump from you.
No, well, I was about to wrap it up. So this is all solid, man.
Good.
We're all good. I appreciate it.
New Pollux development. So
hey, look at that. Well, James, I appreciate it. We will have to get together to do another record we were talking about earlier. But yeah, I appreciate it. I'll get people linked to High Notes. Keep up with all that stuff, and I'm sure you and I will be talking soon.
Absolutely, man. Have a good day.
Thanks, man. You too.